This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the United States is picking a fight with the two other big powers in the world, China and Russia. But is the U.S. overplaying its imperial hand? We'll get an assessment from Dr. Anthony Montero. And two women from the MOVE organization have been released from prison after 41 years behind bars. We'll have details on their homecoming celebrations.
But first, reparations is a hot topic in the Democratic presidential race. Although reparations has always been part of the African-American agenda, only recently have mainstream white politicians endorse the concept. The Burning Spear, the newspaper of the African People's Socialist Party, recently released a radio documentary of the 1982 World Tribunal on Reparations to Black People, held in New York City. One of the featured speakers was Afeni Shakur, the former Black Panther and mother of hip-hop legend Tupac Shakur. Here is her testimony from 37 years ago.
My nephew was beginning first grade in 1968, and that was the year of the infamous UFT teacher strike in this city. And here, thousands of children were left without schools, and so people across this city got together and set up alternative programs. The Black Panther Party was very much involved in that struggle, and I joined that struggle in 1968. By April of 1969, I was in jail, charged with some 350 felonies, including conspiracy to do just about everything there is to conspire to do. We were all acquitted. The state of New York wasted $1.5 million in trying to send us all to jail, but their conspiracy did not end there, and some of them are now political prisoners. It's important for us, however, to begin by understanding what a counterintelligence program really is. A counterintelligence program is a military operation. One goal of any counterintelligence program is to neutralize a hostile agent. The United States government considers all elements of the Black Liberation Movement hostile agents. When the counterintelligence program was aimed at the Black Liberation Movement, there was only one heading in which all Black people fell, and that heading is called Black Hate Extremist Groups. And under that heading fell the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, SCLC, SNCC, CORE, the Black Panther Party, of course, Malcolm X, and anybody that fell any place within those parameters. And that, I believe, covers the general trend existing in any Black family and in any Black community.
That was Afeni Shakur, the former Black Panther and member of the New York 21. Also speaking at that 1982 World Tribunal on Reparations to Black People was Joe Masariki of Black Veterans for Social Justice.
The United States government is guilty of mass genocide and degradation against Africans here in America. The economic wealth and development of this country was built on the backs of Black slave labor. All persons who enjoy the fruits of the so-called democracy today enjoy it at the expense of Black blood, sweat, tears, and lives. As an organization of veterans from World War II to Vietnam War who fought in these wars, our motto is Blacks fight no one else's war no more. We have adopted this motto because of our experience in this country However, this motto doesn't exclude us from fighting our own war. I want to be clear on that. Such as in Tanzania, Namibia, Mississippi, or New York. People who know the anti-war movement know that the type of internal chaos that took place in the military, which helped to stop the war, and that came from people right here in our communities. The whole white anti-war movement couldn't get off the ground until blacks refused. More blacks refused to go into the military during the Vietnam War than whites. 8-2.
That was Joe Masariki of Black Veterans for Social Justice.
The 1982 World Tribunal on Reparations to Black People was organized by the African People's Socialist Party, whose chairman, then and now, is Omali Yeshitela. The politics of that era was deeply influenced by Malcolm X and others who urged blacks to take their case against the United States to an international arena. Omali Yeshitela explains.
Yeah, that's pretty much the way it was. Of course, Malcolm was an extraordinary influence, and Malcolm, of course, represented a revolutionary period, the emergence of a revolutionary period in the United States. And what we were doing in 1982 with the African People's Socialist Party anyway, our objective was to complete the Black Revolution of the 1960s. And there was no reason for us to believe that the United States government was going to solve the very same problems that it was responsible for having created in the first place. And that's how we took on the issue of reparations. We saw reparations as a function of the revolution, not as something that could rely on the beneficence of the United States government or any department of the United States government. So before our entry into this reparations issue, we saw there were different people, you know, carrying their briefcases and trying to get courts to agree that we should have reparations, or trying to get some kind of legislation or legislature to agree that we would do reparations. And what we understood, that if reparations were to ever occur, it was going to be as a consequence of African people ourselves, the masses of people demanding reparations. So we said that reparations has to become a household word, that African people have to demand reparations and not leave it up to the government or any entity associated with the government to make that determination. And that's the basis for pulling together this World Tribunal in the first place, so that African people could come and participate, could hear the discussions, could hear the argument, could learn some things about the international law that in many ways, according to the UN and other entities, actually superseded basic domestic U.S. law. And we felt like doing this also allowed African people to be able to experience something that was like having state power in our own hands. And so this was partially what informed us, that the demand for reparations had to be taken to the masses of the people. And this was the first of 11 years of reparations tribunals held in different states throughout the United States, bringing more and more people into the discussion, into the debate around the question of reparations.
Now, this was 1982. That's 7 years before Congressman John Conyers introduced his H.R. 40 legislation for a study of reparations. And it's also 7 years before the formation of NCOBRA, which is today the largest reparations organization.
It is true. And we felt all along that we wanted everybody to be able to unite with the demand of reparations, regardless of their position, their class positions, or even in many ways their ideological affiliation with the national liberation movement to win that reparations demand. We were quite disappointed. For example, we went to Dellums, who, as you know, was regarded by many as the premier liberal African office holder and politicians. And he was based in Berkeley, California, where we were also doing work. And we were quite disappointed when Dellums could not support the reparations demand, according to his staff, because his base was primarily white liberals in the Berkeley area on the one hand. But on the other hand, Dellums had literally cried in the Congress while calling for reparations for Japanese, reminding people of Japanese childhood friend that he had who was swept into concentration camps by the United States government, but he was incapable of making that demand for African people inside the United States. So it was a huge struggle. I mean, even people like Jesse Jackson, Farrakhan, and a lot of other people were approached to unite with the demand for reparations, but couldn't do it at that time. Since then, of course, we see that something similar, when you saw Reagan in 1989 also offer a pittance that they call reparations to Japanese, who the United States government had thrown into concentration camps, had stolen their land from them. And in many instances, we're talking about people who, most instances, who were so-called U.S. citizens, stole their land from them, stuck them in concentration camps, and then Reagan gave them, in 1989, reparations. And so that turned a lot of naysayers almost overnight into believers in the reparations demand. And this, we saw coming out of that period, that era, the emergence of a group of folk who came together to create what they call Blacks for Reparations in America, and then subsequently named the National Coalition for Blacks Reparations in America, in COBRA. So that was when NCOBRA came into existence. But as you say, we were doing this work 7 years prior to the emergence of NCOBRA. And even after NCOBRA was created, we were holding reparations tribunal throughout the United States and actually taking the reparations demand to other forums of African people throughout the world. In fact, we won solidarity in Northern Ireland from the Irish Republican Socialist Party with the reparations demand, because they were trying to build a case internationally for support and at the same time to isolate the United States government, who at that time was being led by an entertainer whose name was Ronald Wilson Reagan, who was the Donald Trump of his era, who was going to make America great again as well. And so we got the Irish Republican Socialist Party to unite with the reparations demand, to actually have a press conference in Belfast with us, uniting with that demand and actually saying that they would not accept any money from Irish people in the United States who were opposed to the reparations demand and who otherwise were opposed to African people having liberation. And the day after I left Belfast, the British government burned the office to the ground of the IRSP. So it's a thing that we pushed out. And like you said, it happened some 7 years prior to the 1989 Conyers call for a study, the 1989 founding of the NCOBRA, what came to be NCOBRA, et cetera. So that work had been going on for a while.
Historically, the corporate media hasn't given any credence or coverage to reparations for Black folks. Until rather recently, many of these folks learned everything they think they know about reparations from Ta-Nehisi Coates in his articles in The Atlantic. But for whatever reason, reparations is now on the lips of Democratic presidential candidates. It's got a higher corporate media profile than ever.
That's true. And it's interesting because for many years, Nancy Pelosi refused to allow this reparations issue, H.R. 40, to even come out of the committee. And now she's on record as being somebody who supports reparations. But of course, what has occurred is how this crisis of imperialism looks at this very moment. When Donald Trump represents a sector of white power in this country that has more or less won a huge sector of the white electorate to its version of America, this sector that experiences crisis because of how things are changing in the world for itself, the emergence of other contending forces that's undermining this superiority of white people, America, and the economy of the United States. So you've got that Trump thing, and now you've got the other sector of the bourgeoisie, most often consolidated in the Democratic Party, that's trying to rally Africans and other people outside of the white male-dominated narrative to contend with them in a way that's going to advance their own agenda. It's not something that's being advanced because of African people, support for African people, love for African people. We are just objects here now as these two forces contend with each other for power. And so now reparations is on the lips of a lot of different people. And you're going to see even more of the presidential candidates who unite with it, who up to now have not done so. And I'm talking about people like Bernie Sanders, who will come up with something that even if he doesn't want to call it reparations, and Cory Booker. And I think that we might even see Barack Hussein Obama, who initially was opposed to reparations, may have to unite with some version of reparations now just in order to advance the cause of that sector of white power that he represents inside the Democratic Party.
Some of us don't think that white politicians, and maybe not most of the black ones, should be asked to come up with some kind of reparation scheme of their own, that it's up to the masses of black folks to decide what reparations demands that they want to make. But you guys, back in the 1980s, were in fact holding these tribunals so that folks could testify to the meaning and content of reparations.
That's true. And obviously, listen, in January 1st, 1865, William T. Sherman, with some, I forgot what it was called Field Order 15, turned over to black people in this country, January 1st, some 400,000 acres of land from South Carolina that came from a part of South Carolina all the way into Jacksonville, Florida, 30 miles wide, straight down the Atlantic coast, and turned, said, this now belongs to African people. White people can't live here. Only black people can live here. And this was supposed to be more or less the 40 acres and a mule. And of course, by the fall, Andrew Johnson, who succeeded Abraham Lincoln as president, rescinded all of that and said, nope, you can't have it. And then we've seen other instances where the United States government has promised things that reconstruction and even civil rights and Supreme Court rulings that are supposed to favor the interests of African people only to be rescinded when it became convenient for them or when it was necessary for them to carry out a mission that they could do at the expense of black people. And so it would be foolhardy for us to rely on the United States government to come up with some kind of scheme at all. In fact, that's one of the reasons we had the tribunal to put the United States government on trial itself. When we say put the government on trial, we meant every branch of the government, which includes the United States Congress, because none of them has ever proved an ability to speak to the interests of African people. That's something we have to do for ourselves. And the masses of people have to be brought into this in a very serious way. Otherwise, it won't be meaningful, because what otherwise we'll be talking about are those forces inside the African community who are closely tied to some sector of capital or another, some sector of the government or another. And those are the forces that work against African people. So the African people, our population, the mass of people, have to be the driving force here and have to be the ones who make the determination of what reparations mean. For example, just the hearing they had on June 19th, the U.S. subcommittee congressional hearing, you won't hear anything like you heard at our tribunal, where you heard Afeni Shakur, who was from the Black Panther Party, one of the Panther 21, testifying about her treatment, where you heard Akil Aljundi, who was somebody who was at Attica when Rockefeller killed all of those people at Attica, including some of the African prisoners themselves, or the sister from the housing project in Brooklyn who talked about how the apartments are roach and rodent infested, the condition that they live with. These are ordinary masses of our people who have to face this thing every day. And this was another thing that was a departure by the work that we did for the reparations, is not only did we bring people like that, who the masses of people, but we said that reparations are owed to African people, not only for slavery, because the rate of exploitation of black people actually was greater subsequent to slavery than was during the slavery itself. And so this was the demand. We took it beyond the slavery question. We say we need reparations for what has happened to African people 30 minutes ago. And that's how we tried to take the thing out and put it in the possession of the people so that the people can be the driving force around this demand. And it has to happen that way. Otherwise, we will have the Kamala Harrises. We will have the politicians who will come up with a newfangled poverty program or a newfangled welfare program and call it reparations, because they will have the authority, the ability to run it in the interest of the people. The people need to say what this is all about and be able to drive this discussion, so that cannot happen.
That's right. So there can be no resolution of reparations until black folks have spoken.
That's it. That's it. And I think it's really important. You know, as a student of revolution, you know, we read how for the Chinese and for the Russian Revolution, how the peasant question was such a fundamental question in those revolutionary movements. And as the revolutionary process heated up, as the revolutionaries themselves were able to advance their strength, their power, their influence in the society of a crumbling existing social order, and then the peasants themselves didn't wait for the government to give them the land, they began to take the land. And I believe, I am convinced that the moment that reparations actually is something that grabs the brains of African people in this country in a very serious way. And I think such hearings as what happened in Congress will help that to occur, despite what their intent may be. Then masses of African people will begin to get in motion. They won't need me or anybody else to say, hey, this is what reparations look like. They're beginning to say what reparations look like themselves in the various communities that we live in throughout this country. And of course, we have to have the kind of organization that can give us some kind of coherence and some kind of leadership, but the masses are going to be the drivers of this question.
That was Omali Yeshitela of the African People's Socialist Party.
Both the Democrats and Republicans seem intent on waging never-ending hostilities against the two other major powers on the planet, China and Russia, which have responded to U.S. pressures by forming an even closer alliance. For a geopolitical analysis, we turn to Dr. Anthony Montara, the Du Boisian scholar based in Philadelphia.
Well, first of all, the strategic alliance of China and Russia must first of all be understood as a defensive alliance against the predation and aggression economically, militarily, globally, of the United States and the West. So it is defensive in the first instance. In saying this, however, it has to be recognized as a form of state organization and economic management and technological development. China is far more advanced than Russia. China did not experience what the Soviet Union did or what the Russians experienced in the collapse and ruin of their political and economic system. So the trajectory of Chinese development has not experienced the severe interruption that the Soviet Union or what is today Russia experienced. So China is a far more developed system of governance, of economic management, and of technological development. However, the Chinese model is far more developed than the liberal model. And I think when Putin and others look at China and its system, what you call a command economy, we could also call it a state capitalist economy, hedged with conditions of going towards a advanced form of socialist economic organization. When Putin looks at this, he sees greater possibilities for Russia and for other what they call emerging economies in the Chinese model. The Chinese model is far superior to the United States model of economic development. And therefore, you can clearly see China moving at a high rate of speed, way beyond what the United States is capable of, and especially in the fields of technology, of solving major social problems like poverty, climate change, the infrastructure, and on and on and on. The United States is locked in crisis after crisis, and these are what I would call antagonistic contradictions, where China is able to solve its contradictions and problems without posing an existential threat to the entire social, economic, political system.
The United States does not have a policy on economic development. All right. It has is a policy for further enrichment of the already rich classes at the top and creation and maintenance of a state that protects those individuals. But the United States could never contemplate the kind of huge public works program that China and Russia are in the process of creating, the One Road, One Belt project.
Yeah, and you know, the United States nor the West in general has produced the type of intelligentsia that can think in technical and broader macro social terms about addressing such problems. You know, we have an intelligentsia in large part that has looked inward towards the individual, that is incapable of looking at the world and humanity and finding solutions to problems in this moment that will allow humanity to take this great leap forward based upon technology, human intelligence, new means of the management and organization of communities and nations and civilizations. The West is incapable of any of this and is only capable of looking inward and ultimately backward. And this is why the crisis of the West is not just an economic crisis. It is also a civilizational crisis where it is in decline, it is unraveling, the state is incapable of governance, the people have turned against the state, against the principal institutions of the society, and against the leaders of the society. And a lot of people say the American populace has become anti-intellectual. Well, maybe so, but more than just against ideas, the American public is against the intelligentsia, which produces ideas that are of no value to the problems that ordinary people face. This is an existential crisis that the West is in, and the United States, the foundation of the modern West, is more acutely in this crisis than anywhere else in Western civilization.
Typically, we're told that the United States and China are locked in a struggle for world domination. The United States, of course, has no plan to restructure its economy, whereas the Chinese have done a number of makeovers over the last 20 or 30 years and have grown their economy at sometimes a rate of 10%. While the United States and the Europeans languish at 1, 2, and 3%. The United States has nothing to compare, once again, with the Chinese New Silk Road. So how is the United States supposed to overcome China?
Well, it can't overcome China. And this is the importance of the negotiations between the Trump administration and the Chinese government. You know, Trump might not know a lot of things, but there are some things that he understands better than most of his opponents, that the United States, with huge military spending and a military all over the world, cannot compete with China. Too much wasteful military spending that could have been used for productive purposes. $7 trillion spent in Middle East wars and so on. He understands that we cannot compete with China or Asia, but we must cooperate with them. I think that the Trump turn away from Europe, and you see it in the way that he contemptuously treats people like Theresa May or Angela Merkel or the Prime Minister of Canada or Macron. These are our, quote, allies. The way he treats them with contempt and the respect that he shows to, for instance, a Kim Jong-un of a very small nation that does not play a major role in the world economy, or certainly his deference to leaders like Xi Jinping or Vladimir Putin. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's symbolic, it's gesturing, but it does suggest a turn towards Asia, but a turn towards Asia not in the way that Obama had envisioned it, i.e. the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which did not include China, to isolate China, to establish the United States and its allies as hegemonic in the Pacific and Asia. Well, that fell through. Trump threw it away, did not sign it. His approach to Asia is a different one. And of course, it is seeking out, and this comes out of the G20 meetings and his statements about his meetings with Xi Jinping, he looks at a different type of relationship with China, in a sense, one based upon two mature economies. But his recognition also, and he said this during the campaign, that if you go to the Chinese airports, if you go to the Chinese, you ride on a Chinese train, you know, all of these things of superstructure, that China is way beyond the United States. Now, you know, he talks a lot like about Huawei and what he's going to do and so on, or the Russian natural gas pipeline to Western Europe and Germany. But the fact of the matter, in some ways, he wants to slow down the process, which is inevitable. But in other ways, he recognizes that if the United States economy and nation is to have a future outside of a civil war, it must be an engagement with this rapidly rising Asia, and especially China and India and Russia, and ultimately the Koreas and Japan and Iran.
Frankly, Dr. Monteiro, I don't know how you can base an analysis on anything that Trump says. I think he tends to forget what he said right after he does say it. What it appears that he intended to do was to force U.S.-based corporations to sever their long supply chains to China, and has, in fact, succeeded to a degree in doing that, although these supply chains don't now begin again in the United States, but they've gone to Vietnam and other low-cost labor countries.
Right, right. Well, yes, that's true. But I do think that, you know, if you listen to Trump, not through the lens of the corporate media, you hear certain different things. And I think if you listen to Trump, let us say, with the ears or eyes of an elite in China or in Russia, you hear something different. Because the response, let us say, of Putin or Xi Jinping or Kim Jong-un or President Moon of South Korea, or even the Prime Minister of Japan, their response to Trump and the way they hear Trump and the way they read Trump is radically different from the way most of the elites in this country read or hear him, and certainly most of the elites in Western Europe read or hear him. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm not trying to just hear what he says and often his bad grammar or his many of the tweets that we hear. But I was trying to listen. And that's why the G20 in Osaka, Japan was important for me. I was trying to see how he interacts with and how leaders of Asia hear, see, and interact with him. And that was key for me.
In a recent talk, I said that there is no real split in the U.S. ruling class. They are just having problems organizing their two duopoly parties and deciding how to manage the U.S. electorate, but that there was no basic fundamental split in the U.S. ruling class on fundamental policy. But then you pointed out to me that Mr. Soros, the liberal billionaire, and the Koch brothers, who personify right-wing politics, have come together to create a think tank that's going to promote a policy of no regime change and getting along with other countries, which would represent a split in the ruling class.
You know, Glenn, we live in very interesting times. And like your position, that there is no fundamental split. And that's yet to be seen, because a non-fundamental or non-antagonistic split or contradiction could become an antagonistic one. So maybe, maybe not. But I do think that move by Soros and Charles Koch is so interesting, because it suggests something about where the American people are. And here you have the Democrats who are trying to run to the left of Trump on domestic policy and to the right of Trump on foreign policy. In other words, and I got this from you, I think we both kind of came to this in 2016 when we were at the Democratic Party convention here in Philadelphia, that the Democratic Party at its leadership levels has become the party of war. And ironically, Trump's Republican Party is closer to the sentiment of the majority of American people, including the base of the Republican Party, who are white people. And that sentiment that they are tired of war. And Trump, now I know he's not supposed to understand things like this, but I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. He recognizes that, and Soros and Charles Koch understand it too, that endless war at some point could be transformed into no longer foreign wars, but civil war at home because of the austerity and deprivation and impoverishment of the American people to continue these wars. They understand that. We understood it. We've understood it for some time. I find there is a historical analogy between the period 1917 to 1919 and this moment. Literally 100 years ago, the United States enters World War I, not to necessarily end the war on the side of Britain and France as against Germany, but to enter the war in order to be the global hegemon and mediator. Woodrow Wilson comes forward with 14 points for a democratic reorganization and a law-based organization of international relations between the dominant colonial and imperial nations to prevent war. And thus, they talked about World War I as the war to end all wars. Well, there was another position in the world, too, and that was Lenin and the Russian Revolution. But look at today. There has to be an end to war. If there is not, what they call the populist movements, be they left or right, will continue to grow in power and could ultimately, if not brought over to the side of the liberal ruling class, could lead to a revolution or prolonged civil strife within the main capitalist countries. That's what Charles Koch sees, that's what Soros sees, and interestingly, that's what Trump tapped into. In fact, Putin, in his interview with the Financial Times, says that Trump tapped into a dissatisfaction of the American working class and middle classes over issues of wages, economic conditions, which are class questions, and war and peace. And he exploited it. And frankly, as long as the Democrats are the party of war, they can never win the election in 2020.
Well, certainly Putin is not going to make an analysis that includes the racial situation in the United States,
no.
But we must.
Yes, we must. And of course, but see, this is so interesting that when we talk about the unraveling of the American liberal establishment, at the root of it is the incompleteness of the Civil War and Reconstruction. I mean, you literally have to go back 150 years to really understand this crisis. And it was the hope at the start of the 20th century that the liberal order in the United States could be expanded by undermining or doing away with Jim Crow and white supremacy as the organizing principles of U.S. society. They would not do it. The civil rights movement said through King and through others that we want to make America what it said it was about. But it was not to be, because the ruling class and the liberal order could not envision a system that did not include white privilege for white workers and white people generally. Well, now, you not only have the problem of the black community, which is marginalized, super exploited, racially oppressed, in prison, ghettoized, and all the rest, but now you have, based upon, as you called it, the neoliberal global order, the white working masses and middle classes faced with a crisis the likes of which they had not experienced since the Great Depression. It is this kind of coming together of the racial contradiction and the order based upon racial superiority and white supremacy, and the class contradiction of white workers having to face the fact that now there are no guarantees, there are no unions, there is no social safety net, there's only austerity and war, where now these two principal foundations of the contradiction of American liberal society are converging into what looks like a movement, or could be a movement, that will fundamentally change this society. Now, of course, not tomorrow, not in 4 years, not in the 2020 election, but this is a long-term trajectory and process.
That was Dr. Anthony Montero speaking from Philadelphia.
Two of the MOVE organization's political prisoners have been released on parole after 41 years of incarceration. Janet Africa and Janine Africa are part of the MOVE 9, imprisoned in the death of a Philadelphia policeman in 1978. Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was also imprisoned in the death of a cop, has helped arrange a New York City welcome for Janet and Janine Africa. Activist Gwen Dubrow gives us some background on the MOVE organization.
Well, it's a long history. They've been around since the early 70s. They were founded by John Africa, who unfortunately is deceased. He died in the May 13, 1985 bombing of the MOVE compound. He, along with five other adults, died, along with five children, died on May 13, 1985, coincidentally Mother's Day. They are a back-to-nature, revolutionary, radical group founded on the basis of all life is worthy of something and should be respected. I would put them as your early environmental activists. They support all life, all living human beings and forms of life like dogs and other such animals, air. We should have clean air. There should be no zoos. There should be no pet centers where you can go and buy a pet. They believe that all life is worthy of something and it should be free.
Now, back in 1978, the Philadelphia police surrounded the house where MOVE members lived with massive force and water cannons and such, and besieged the place. During that siege, a policeman was killed.
Indeed, yes. Officer James Ramp was killed on that day by friendly fire, but what happened is the police ended up charging the MOVE 9 with his death, even though they knew darn well that it was one of their own that had killed Officer James Rant, because they were going in to, supposedly they wanted to remove them from their home, but that wasn't their intention at all. Their intention was to kill them and thereby destroying the MOVE organization and their radical beliefs. And in the end, what happened, unfortunately, an officer's life was tragically lost. But it was lost by friendly fire. They were in the house, in the basement. Their guns weren't even loaded or anything. They were filled with water, and there was no way that any of the MOVE 9 could have killed anyone because they were in the basement in their home, and there's absolutely no physical evidence linking the Move 9 to the officer's death. In fact, Officer Ramp was on holiday and came back. I guess he thought he was going to have a cowboy fun time. And I guess he thought he was going to kill some people. And unfortunately, it ended up the other way around. He ended up dying, unfortunately.
The Move 9 received what amounts to lifetime sentences in jail. And in fact, a number of the Move members did die in prison.
Correct. Merle Africa died in March 1998. And Philip Africa, unfortunately, passed 4 years ago, January 15th, I believe, 2015. And we still really don't know what happened. What happened with both of them? What, you know, they just died. Tragic. And we don't know what happened, you know, what led up to it, anything like that. But I actually have one of Phil Africa's paintings. He was a fantastic painter and a lovely human being. And it truly is a loss for the Move family and for humanity in general.
And as you mentioned, 7 years later, in 1985, the cops came back and bombed the Move house with terrible loss of life.
Indeed, yes, they did. They were killed. A bomb was dropped on them, and the fire ensued, and they wouldn't even put the fire out. And there were two survivors of the assault, Ramona and the young boys, who did survive, but actually a few years later, they did a movie about Move, a documentary called Let the Fire Burn, actually. And when that documentary was released, strangely enough, the other survivor, the young man, died on a cruise. So I don't know what that's about. I find that terribly suspicious, him dying all of a sudden when a documentary about Move was released. And this young man dies on a cruise. I think he drowned in a jacuzzi or something like that. Very strange indeed. But Move survives. Thank God. Thank God for Move. I met them about 15 years ago. I didn't know anything about Move. But as soon as I met Ramona, I come to love and appreciate John Africa as well. Because what he says makes a lot of sense. We ought to have more respect for all forms of life. And as we speak today, Black people are still dealing with police brutality and assault on our lives every single day of our lives. We have to fear the police or someone killing us for no other reason but the fact that we're Black.
But some Move 9 members remain in prison.
Yes, Chuck Africa remains there and Delbert Africa remains there. As a matter of fact, if you Google or you go on YouTube, you can find pictures film of the police beating Delbert Africa to a pulp. I believe he's 78 years old, and he goes up for parole, I believe, in another 5 years. He got a five-year hit, but hopefully there'll be redress of that, and his parole hearing will come up sooner than 5 years. Chuck Africa has a parole hearing coming up in December, so it's crucial that we send letters to the parole board in reference to Chuck Africa and Delbert Africa, that they deserve to be released. They've all served over 40 years in prison for a crime they did not commit. And you can get more information about sending your parole letters. Go to the website onamove.com, and you'll see further information about how to send your letter to the parole board.
Folks need to know that Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, was one of the few reporters, he was a journalist in Philadelphia, that covered the Move organization and the police repression of that organization. Back in 1981, he himself wound up in the clutches of the cops and has been in prison ever since. But Mumia Abu-Jamal is a sponsor of this welcome that New York City is offering to Jeanette Africa and Janine Africa at the People's Forum on July 19th.
Yes, Mumia has graciously offered his support behind this event, and we encourage everyone within the sound of my voice who can come out, meet these wonderful women, these brave women. I don't know that I could have survived 41 years in prison for something that I didn't do, but these women did, and they're a living testament of women warriors fighting for the same things that we fight for, our own liberty in supposedly a democratic country. This country doesn't even acknowledge that we have political prisoners, but we do. We certainly do. Mumia is a political prisoner. Delbert and Chuck are political prisoners. Mutulu Shakur is a prisoner. Jaleel Monteking. We have about 50 other political prisoners. Linda Peltier, a political prisoner, innocent as well. But the state pounces on us because a lot of times we can't afford the best defense money can buy, like Jeffrey Epstein. So, yeah, we're having this welcome reception for Janine and Janet Africa on Friday, July 19th at the People's Forum. And we encourage people to come out and support them because, yes, they're released, but they have no, what are they going to live on? There's no Social Security check for being freedom fighters. No such thing exists. So we want to give them a little cushion so they can restart their lives. Because when you go to prison, your life stops. It's essentially you belong to the state. And once you're released, they don't do anything for you. They have to get jobs. They have to get IDs. They have to get a place to live. So we want to help them because they have given up a lot. For people that can't make it but would like to donate a little something, we would really appreciate you doing that. You can go to Fundraise and just look up Janet and Janine Africa Relief Fund. Janet and Janine Africa on fundraise.com.
That was social activist Gwen Dubrow speaking from New York City.
Four of the U.S. activists that defended the Venezuelan embassy in Washington from takeover by Donald Trump's hand-picked puppets face up to a year in prison. Glenn Ford has this report.
The United States is not a civilized nation. It doesn't even know how to act civilized, to pretend to be part of a civilized global society. Diplomacy is an essential element in the evolution of human civilization. Especially in recent centuries, nations have agreed that the national boundaries of all countries, big and small, are to be respected except in times of war, and that the embassies of foreign nations are not to be intruded upon or violated, but must be treated as if they are foreign sovereign soil. Without respect for embassies, diplomacy is impossible and war becomes constant. That's why the inviolability of embassies is enshrined in international law, a hallmark of civilization. But centuries of law and history don't mean a damn thing to Donald Trump, who earlier this year decided that he would replace the elected president of Venezuela with somebody of his own choosing. Trump picked out a guy named Guaido, a member of the Venezuelan legislature from a far right-wing party, whom 80% of Venezuelans had never heard of, and told this guy, Guaido, to declare himself president. Then the United States and its British allies confiscated all the Venezuelan national property they could lay their hands on, billions of dollars in assets, supposedly on behalf of this guy, Juan Guaido. This is barbarism, conduct beyond the pale of modern civilized nations. Donald Trump is behaving just like the white settlers of the colonial era, who would find a Native American, get him drunk, call him a chief of his people, and then have the drunken Indian sign a treaty giving away all of his people's land, or some other tribe's land. Guaido is Trump's drunken Indian. The Trump administration then forced Venezuela's diplomats out of the United States. But before they left, the Venezuelans entrusted care of their embassy in Washington to a group of American activists who called themselves the Embassy Protectors. For 37 days, the embassy protectors defended the building from hundreds of screaming and often violent right-wing supporters of Trump and Guaido. Finally, in May, four of the embassy protectors submitted to arrest by the Secret Service. Kevin Zeese, Margaret Flowers, David Paul, and Adrian Pine are charged with interfering with the Secret Service's performance of its duties to protect embassies. But in fact, the Secret Service did nothing to protect the embassy from the right-wing mob that besieged it for more than a month, vandalizing property and attacking the American activists when they tried to go out and get food. The Trump Justice Department wants to make examples of the embassy protector defendants, who face up to a year in prison and a $100,000 fine. It's going to be a long trial, and it's going to cost money. But this is about defending civilization and the rule of law, without which the planet is condemned to endless war. To find out how you can help, go to defendembassyprotectors.org. I'm Glenn Ford, Black Agenda Report.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.